Well, good afternoon. Welcome. So good to see everybody here tonight. I hope you all had a really good afternoon. Did anybody get a nap? That's nice when you can do that. And we hopefully recharged our physical batteries. Now we get to come here this evening and recharge our spiritual batteries. I can't think of a better way to end a weekend and start a new week than to do that, to prepare ourselves for the challenges that lie ahead of us throughout the week. We don't even really know what they're going to be, do we? We're going to be confronted with things through the week, though I promise you that are going to challenge your faith and they're going to improve what you're made of spiritually. So hopefully we'll be able to head some of those things off. We'll be able to prepare for some of those things spiritually. We've been singing God's praises and we've been praying to Him, and now we're going to study His Word. I encourage you to open up to the book of 1 Corinthians in your New Testament. We're going to open to chapter 10. We're going to read the first 13 verses there, talk about some things that happened to the children of Israel and their wilderness wandering, and how Paul applied these things to the brethren at Corinth, and how he taught them some lessons about how to please God. And hopefully we can learn how to be pleasing to God through the week ahead and through the rest of our lives, so that we can go to heaven, where that place will be, where there are no tears that we just sang about. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, starting in verse 1. "For I do not want you to be unaware, brethren, that our fathers were all under the cloud, and all passed through the sea, and all were baptized into Moses, in the cloud and in the sea, and all ate the same spiritual food and drank the same spiritual drink. For they were drinking from a spiritual rock which followed them, and the rock was Christ. Nevertheless, with most of them, God was not well pleased, for they were laid low in the wilderness." Your version of the Bible may say their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. "Now these things happened as examples for us, so that we would not crave evil things as they also craved. Do not be idolaters, as some of them were, as it is written, 'The people sat down to eat and drink and stood up to play.' Nor let us act immorally, as some of them did, and 23,000 fell in one day. Nor let us try the Lord, as some of them did, and were destroyed by serpents. Nor grumble, as some of them did, and were destroyed by the destroyer. Now these things happened to them as an example, and they were written for our instruction, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. Therefore let him who thinks he stands take heed that he does not fall. No temptation has overtaken you but such as is common to man. And God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with the temptation will provide the way of escape also, so that you will be able to endure it." Now, I've often said from this pulpit that the Corinthian letters were written for our benefit, to teach us what God doesn't like, to teach us what not to do as individual Christians on a day-to-day basis, and when we assemble together as a church, what not to do there as well. Now, it was obviously written to them, to the church at Corinth, to correct some errors that they were involved in. But I believe it was written ultimately for us as an example to not misbehave as they did, to live moral lives, to worship God correctly. They just mishandled the worship of God so terribly in so many different ways in that church. And I believe that we can learn so much of what not to do from what these brethren did. And in this passage, Paul directed their attention, the brethren there in the city of Corinth, toward other sections of inspired Scripture to show them that some things were written for their example, as a teaching tool for them to follow after, for them to learn to curb their evil desires, for them to learn to live righteously before the Lord on a daily basis. And he uses several Old Testament teaching points there, several Old Testament events as teaching points, mostly from the book of Numbers, as the children of Israel were delivered from Egyptian slavery and the 40-year period it took them to finally enter into the promised land as they were wandering around from place to place. He uses that period of Israel's existence to teach them a lot of lessons, to address some specific problems that were prevalent there in the Corinthian church. So let's just look at some of those things together. He started there in verse 6, and he said, "These things happened to them," these bad things, God's punishment of them, how God scattered their bodies in the wilderness, the bodies of many of them. He said, "These things happened to them as examples for us, so that we would learn not to lust after or crave after evil things." Now, this is likely a reference to what took place in Numbers chapter 11. We'll read there in verses 4 through 6 of Numbers chapter 11. "The rabble who were among them had greedy desires, and also the sons of Israel wept again and said, 'Who will give us meat to eat? We remember the fish which we used to eat free in Egypt, the cucumbers and the melons and the leeks and the onions and the garlic. But now our appetite is gone. There is nothing at all to look at except this manna. And this was really just shortly after God had freed them from their captivity. They were still in Sinai at this point, and they were just longing for the good old days of Egypt. Why was it that these people wanted to go back to slavery? Why did they want to go back to Egypt? Well, it says here that they craved evil things. Now, let me ask you, is there anything evil about cucumbers or melons or onions or garlic that they were craving after? Surely not garlic. That's actually used to ward off evil things, right? Like vampires. So we know that's not evil. But seriously, that wasn't the problem. The problem wasn't the food. The evil was that they desired things that God did not want for them. God wanted better things for them. He had better things in store for them than what they had back in the days of their slavery. But all they were worried about at this point was their appetite. Oh, they said, our appetite is gone, and all we have is just this bread, this manna. We don't really know what it is. That's what the word manna literally means. What is it? It was a curiosity to them, and they got tired of it. And they were just bemoaning the agony of it all. Woe is us. We're so hungry and we don't get what we want. But you know what I really think the issue was with the children of Israel at this point? Why they actually wanted to go back? I think it's because they became comfortable in their own misery there. They had become comfortable in that familiar type of misery they were used to. It wasn't pleasant there, but it was familiar. Yes, they were slaves back there, but they had some fringe benefits. Yes, they were beaten quite frequently, but they got their bellies full with all these tasty morsels. So that was just such a good thing to think about. And very likely, they were remembering things to be better than they really were. Now, have you ever done that? Have you ever reminisced about the good old days, long for the days of your youth, those days gone by when you were younger and life was much more exciting? You ever stop and do that? Very likely what you're doing is remembering the good stuff, and that's why it's so enticing. That's why you're so tempted to want to go back there. But there are a lot of bad things happening back there too, right? The lyrics of the song say the good old days weren't always good, and that's exactly right. All we want to remember are the good things, and that's why we refer to those as the good old days. But these guys wanting to go back to slavery because of onions and garlic and melons, come on, now get real. Is that really a good reason to want to go back to that? But these people, I believe, had become what we might term institutionalized. They had become very accustomed to their slavery. They were still mental slaves. They were still set in their ways. And with the slightest bit of adversity, when that entered into their life, they reverted back to the old, familiar, comfortable ways. Their bodies were freed from captivity, but their minds were still enslaved. They never broke those mental patterns. Their feet were walking in the promised land, but their hearts were still in Egypt, be it ever so humble or ever so terrible or miserable or dysfunctional. There's no place like home. What's the lesson for us from this particular passage of Scripture about craving after evil things? I believe it's this. Don't long for the good old days of sin. Do you ever do that? You ever look back at those days that you lived outside of Christ and you just long for the fun that you used to have? The memories are so good. But let me tell you, there's nothing back there of true value for you to go to. What we need to do as those who have been freed from the slavery of sin in Christ Jesus, we need to work on breaking those mental patterns, those old mental habits that are so hard to break. When things get tough, when we feel that tug of that old familiar, comfortable misery pulling us back to where we don't need to be, we need to stop the madness somehow. We need to break those chains that keep us attached to that former life in sin. We need to slap ourselves in the face mentally. And I'm all for slapping ourselves in the face physically if we need to do that, if that's what it's going to take to wake us up and to break that spell. And we need to pray fervently, like our life depends on it. We need to pray for God to help us. We need to stop the internal dialogue when that's going on. When we're thinking about the good old days and how we'd like to go back, we're talking to ourselves. And we're, you know what? Eventually we'll talk ourselves in to going right back to Egypt, to go right back to that slavery. We need to break that pattern. We need to stop talking to ourselves And you know who we need to start talking to? When you start talking to God. That's right. We need to pour it out on Him. We need to let Him know that we're sliding, that we're slipping, that we're weak, that we can't do it on our own. And we need to ask Him to help pull us up and pull us away from those old destructive patterns. And look, if you do insist on talking to yourself and keeping that internal dialogue going on with yourself, tell yourself, I'm not going back. There's nothing to go back to in the land of slavery. And then in verse 7, he said there, do not be idolaters as some of them were. Now, idolatry was a big problem in the city of Corinth. It was just a city loaded with temples and shrines. And these brethren came out of idolatry when they were converted to Christ. At least they tried to come. They were having a hard time coming completely out of idolatry. Once again, those old habits are very hard to break. Those old patterns, those old routines, they don't die easily. We've got to put up a fight because they want to pull us back. And the example that was used there in verse 7, how the children sat down to eat and rose up to play, was a reference to what took place in Exodus chapter 32 when Israel worshipped that golden calf. After Moses was up in the mountain so long, they said, you know, he's never coming back. They told Aaron to make them a god that they could worship. But what I want us to turn our attention to is something that's said in Deuteronomy chapter 7, verses 5 and 6 about idolatry. Deuteronomy chapter 7, verses 5 and 6 says this, and this is Moses addressing the children of Israel before they went into the promised land to take it over. He said to them, but thus you shall do to them. You shall tear down their altars and smash their sacred pillars and hew down their asherim and burn their graven images with fire. For you are a holy people to the Lord your God. The Lord your God has chosen you to be a people for His own possession out of all the peoples who are on the face of the earth. Now I want you to notice what Moses did not tell them to do. He didn't say, don't worship idols. He didn't say, stay as far away from these idols as you possibly can. He didn't say, turn your back on them and never look at them. What he said was, smash and burn them. Crush, kill, destroy them. If you leave these things hanging around, guess what's going to happen? You're just going to go back to them. You're going to gravitate to those things in a moment of weakness. When things aren't going well in your life, when you're feeling a little frustrated, when you're feeling a little aggravated, when you're feeling tempted, those old idols are going to be back there for you to go to. So he says, you got to destroy them. You got to wipe them out. So, the lesson for us, if we really want to break those old patterns of sinfulness, of reverting back to our old ways, if we really want to stop the madness, to stay away from those old destructive routines, we got to tear down our idols. We have to burn our graven images. We have to smash our sacred pillars, those things that were sacred to us when we were of a worldly nature. Now, I'll give you some practical examples of that. And these things are going to seem kind of harsh, but I think this is what God is telling us. Do whatever it takes to keep from repeating these old destructive patterns. So, for example, if you can't get a handle on your spending, don't take the credit card out of your wallet, stick it in your drawer. Take the scissors out and cut that thing up. And that's going to help you get a handle on your spending. And if you can't stay away from pornography or looking at things that you have a hard time staying away from, whatever it may be, don't just turn the computer off. Donate it to somebody. Now, I used to say, throw the computer away or destroy it. Don't do that. Donate it to somebody. If we can't keep our eyes away from the filth, we got to do what we need to do to get the filth from out of our sight, from out of our path. If we can't keep from lusting, if we have such a hard time doing that, we need to stop looking. Don't pluck your eyeballs out, literally. Don't do that. But do whatever you can to stay away from the things that tempt you visually. Stay away from the girl down the street if she's a temptation to you. Don't leave your workstation at the job you work at to visit that fella if you're attracted to him. So it's things like that. If you can't control your tongue, no, don't cut it out. Don't do that. That's not a good idea. But eliminate the source of the problem as best you can. Stop hanging around with people who gossip a lot if you have a big problem with gossip. Stop hanging around with people who curse a lot if you have a big problem with cursing. Stop reading material and watching shows that promote those kind of things if you have problems with those kinds of things. Now, there are a couple of things written in 1 Corinthians that Paul tells us to flee from, to actually run from. And idolatry is one of those things. It says there in this chapter. We go on to read on down in verse 14. It says, flee from idolatry. This is just one of those kind of sins that we just need to run from, that we need to break loose from. We need to do everything we can to break those patterns. The other thing that Paul tells us to flee from is fornication. He says, flee fornication in 1 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 18. The city of Corinth, we need to understand, was a very important city. It was a port city, and it was just filled with sailors and prostitutes, and it had just a terrible reputation for being a morally debased kind of city. The people who lived there and the people who played there were just of the basest sort. And we read there in verse 8, 1 Corinthians chapter 10, let us not act immorally. He's talking about sexual immorality. As some of them did, and 23,000 fell in one day. Now, that was in reference to what took place in Numbers chapter 25, when the men of Israel went into the Moabite women and they committed fornication with them. We'll read about that in Numbers 25, verses 1 and 2. While Israel remained in Shittim, the people began to play the harlot with the daughters of Moab. For they invited the people to the sacrifices of their gods, and the people ate and bowed down to their gods. And we learn in other places in the Bible, we go on down in Numbers 31 and Revelation chapter 2, we read that Balaam put the Moabites up to this. Balaam wouldn't curse Israel for Balak, the king of Moab. So instead of doing that, he taught that king to put a stumbling block before Israel. He taught them to curse themselves is what he did. And that's how they did it. That's how the Moabite king did it. He had the Moabite women seduce the Israelite men. And they committed fornication with them. And I want you to see how serious a sin fornication is to God. God, he just doesn't play around with this. Numbers chapter 25 and verse 9 says, in all, 24,000 people were killed because of sexual immorality at that time. But we read there in 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 7 that 23,000 of them were killed in one day. God wiped out 23,000 people in one day to prove a point to us, to teach us a lesson that we really need to flee fornication. We really need to flee sexual immorality. It is a killer. It will do us in. It will destroy our lives. It will destroy our families. And most importantly, folks, it will destroy our souls. So we need to make sure we do whatever we can to keep from committing sexual sin. God is so displeased with us when we do that. If we think that we can live immoral lives and still be pleasing to God, we fool ourselves. And we better not do that. That's just not a wise thing to do. Verse 9 of 1 Corinthians chapter 10 says, we should learn not to tempt the Lord as these people did, as Israel did. Now we read there, nor let us try or tempt the Lord as some of them did and were destroyed by the serpents. And that is a reference to what happened in Numbers chapter 21, verses 4 through 6. We'll read that together. Numbers 21, verses 4 through 6 says, then they set out from Mount Hor by the way of the Red Sea to go around the land of Edom. And the people became impatient, or they became discouraged, your version of the Bible may say, because of the journey. And the people spoke against God and Moses, and they said, why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? For there is no food and no water, and we loathe this miserable food. Then the Lord sent fiery serpents among the people, and they bit the people so that many of the people of Israel died. The Israelites tested God. They spoke out against God. They spoke out against His chosen leaders. They questioned God's motives for rescuing them. They questioned His love for them. And it all came back to food again. Did you notice that? They were accusing God of withholding the good stuff. They have no food and no water. And oh, we just hate this bread that you've given us. But I want you to notice what triggered the whole thing. What triggered all of their doubt and frustration? It said there in verse 4, when we read, the people became impatient because of the journey. Or the people became discouraged because of the journey. Numbers chapter 21 and verse 4. Now, to explain to you what had happened prior to that, it might give you a better understanding of what this impatience was all about. The children of Israel had just soundly defeated the Canaanites at a place called Hormah. And they named it Hormah because that word literally means utter destruction. So in other words, Israel came up against some Canaanites and they just completely obliterated them. They wiped them out. So I'm sure they felt invincible at this time. They were just full of themselves. They knew they could destroy anybody. So then it says that they journeyed from Mount Hor by the way of the Red Sea to go around the land of Edom. And the reason why they had to go around the land of Edom is because Moses asked the king of Edom, could he go through their land? And the king of Edom said, no, you can't go through. He refused that request. So can't you just hear the Israelites' response to that? Can't you just hear them saying, well, who are they to refuse us? Didn't we just utterly obliterate the people at Hormah? Who are these people to stand before us? Let's go right through Edom and let's just destroy them as we did the Canaanites. But God said, no, you can't do that. You have to go around them. They were distant relatives of Israel, and God said, they're your brothers, and I want you to bring no harm to them. So that caused Israel to be impatient because of the journey. That made their journey more difficult. Instead of going straight through, they had to circumvent that whole big territory. And that was more time-consuming. And that was more difficult. And they grew impatient. And they grew discouraged. And they started fussing. So God tested his people at this time. And they failed the test. He made the journey a little tougher than it had to be. It wasn't a breeze. They couldn't just waltz right through and do what they wanted to do. So they became frustrated. And that's the way it is with us sometimes too, isn't it? The journey gets tough for us on this earth sometimes, doesn't it? Sometimes the going gets rough and things are not always easy and convenient for us. You know what? That's just life. That's just the way life is sometimes. Sometimes we're going to be inconvenienced. Sometimes we're going to be called to walk a difficult road. But here's what we need to be careful to not do when we're in the midst of doing that. And that is, in our impatience, we need to be careful to not turn on God. To not speak against God, to not turn on Him, to not turn on His chosen leaders for us. Because God and His leaders are here to help us. They're here to make the journey as easy as possible for us. Yes, we're going to be tested along the way. But we need God more than ever at those times. And we need the leaders He has in place more than ever. And Israel found out really that things could get a whole lot tougher when they turn on God. And that's exactly what happened. They got frustrated with God. They turned on Him. And what did God do? It says He sent them fiery serpents and bit some of them. And many of them died because of that. Now evidently these serpents, they were just full of poisonous venom that caused raging fevers within them. And it led to agonizing deaths for some of them. But really it wasn't God who made it tougher on them. They made it tougher on themselves because of their impatience. Let me tell you something about the God that we serve. And this seems very unfair, and you know what it may be, but this is just the way it is. The God we serve has every right to test us. But we have no right whatsoever to test Him. It is our job as followers of God and privileged takers of all His good benefits to take the bad with the good and to just serve Him with all of our ability and to be appreciative of Him and to do that as best we can. As long as we can, as long as we're on this earth. Now, it's interesting to me that these people did repent of their sin. They turned from that. They said, we're sorry, we shouldn't have done that. So God sent them an antidote for these snake bites. He had Moses erect a brass serpent on a pole. And everyone who looked at that serpent after they were bit, they were cured from the illness that the snake venom caused. But I want you to notice what God did not do for them. At this time, when they repented, He didn't take the serpents away. I find that to be very interesting. Sometimes in our impatience and in our frustration, we make terrible choices. We make terrible mistakes. God doesn't always take away our problems. Even if He gives us a way to ameliorate them, even if He gives us a way to soothe the pain, even if He forgives us, sometimes He makes us live with the consequences of our bad choices. And we need to learn to just stay faithful to God and to deal with those things that we brought on ourselves if God doesn't take them away completely and stay faithful to Him all the while. The last one, verse 10, the last thing we learn what not to do from the children of Israel as they were wandering through the wilderness is we are to not grumble. It says in verse 10, as some of them did and were destroyed by the destroyer. Now this idea of grumbling and complaining, murmuring, your version of the Bible may say, it was just a persistent problem with God's people at this time. And this is probably a specific reference to what happened in Numbers 16, although it could be a reference to any number of incidences with the children of Israel. But after there was a rebellion, that was made by a man named Korah, God killed the rebels and their families. Then the children of Israel turned on Moses and Aaron and said, "You are to blame for the children of Israel being killed. You are to blame for the death of the Lord's people." It said that in verse 41 of Numbers 16. And that destroyer that God sent them was in the shape of a terrible plague. It's not said what the plague is, but it was something that killed nearly 15,000 people before God took that plague away. But what we need to learn about grumbling and complaining is that God is just very displeased with us if we have that kind of attitude, that kind of mentality. Look, we're all going to complain about something at some time or another, but if that's who we are, if we're grumblers, if we're complainers at heart, we need to try to turn that around because God doesn't like that. You know what that's an indication of? That's an indication of overall dissatisfaction with the good things that God has given to us in this life. It's a sinful thing to be dissatisfied with God's good graces. Did you know that? God's people should be the happiest people in the whole world. Every good thing is available to mankind. He has made available to us through Christ Jesus. We have access to that. And we just have the hope of heaven when this life is over, even if things don't go perfectly for us on this earth. So there's really no reason for us to be dissatisfied with things. You know what the real problem is with that attitude of dissatisfaction and discontentment? I think it's that we focus on the things that aren't going right in our life, the things that are negative in our life, the things that we would like to have differently, instead of focusing on all the things that we have that are good in our life, all the things that are going well. I'm looking at a bunch of blessed people here this afternoon. I'm convinced of that. God has blessed every one of us greatly. And I think if we were to weigh in the balances the good things in our life against the bad things, I don't think there would be any comparison when all is said and done. In the grand scheme of things, we are so overwhelmingly blessed in this nation, in this church, in God's kingdom, and we need to be focusing on those good things, and that'll help our overall attitude, and we'll be upbeat, pleasant people, and we'll be an attraction for other people to God instead of something that repels them, instead of something that pushes them away. I think it's so amazing that Paul used examples of people's behavior from nearly 1,500 years earlier to help the Corinthian brethren. And look, not just people in the world, God's own people, their bad behavior. From 1,500 years earlier, he used that to teach them lessons. And there they were falling into the same old traps that these people were. The same old sins, the same old patterns, repeating those things. And here we are today, some 2,000 years removed from Paul's day, and we are using the behavior of God's people back then to learn lessons about what not to do. And here we are 3,500 years removed from the wilderness wandering, and God's people still repeat the same type of destructive patterns as they did way back then. 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 5, we read it. It says, "God was not pleased with most of them, and he scattered their bodies in the wilderness." Let's learn from their bad examples to do what makes God happy. Let's learn from God's own people what not to do so that we can have the best lives that we can have here on earth and so that we can be with God in eternity forever in heaven. You go ahead and pick up your songbooks. We'll sing number 197 to give you an opportunity to obey the gospel this evening, to put on Christ in baptism, or if you have any other spiritual need, we stand ready to help you in any way that we can. I just want to say this. I find it very frustrating when the very intelligent people of the world dismiss the Bible as fantasy and say it's just a bunch of fairy stories, it's pure fiction, only the naive believe it. Let's get real here. I mean, you think about this. There is no piece of literature ever written that has nailed the nature of the human condition better than the collection of books that we call the Bible. God is just, he knows us inside and out. He knows our comings and our goings. He knows what we think, how we behave, how we react to any given situation as a people, generally speaking. And he knows what's best for us. He wrote these things for us. And we have every reason to believe these things when we read them. God is teaching us here that we can resist the temptation to do the things that these people did if we want to. Last passage of Scripture, we read it earlier. 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 13, Paul wrote once again, "No temptation has overcome you but such as is common to man. And God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with the temptation will provide the way of escape also, so that you will be able to endure it. Let's look for the way out. It says there clearly, God will not tempt us beyond what we can endure, but He'll make a way for escape. Let's look for that door when we're tempted to sin. Let's look for that escape route. Let's look for a way to flee, to run, to not give in to temptation, to not give in to the temptation of lust, to fornication, to grumble, complain, to desire to go back to that life that we escaped from, into the slavery of sin and religious error. God is just too good, and eternity is just too long to go back. Can we help you this evening? We stand ready to do that. If you have any spiritual need whatsoever at this moment in time, you come up here and talk to me about those things while we're standing and singing to your encouragement.